Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. How many new jobs do you suppose is too many new jobs? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday today, the third day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Sure, yes. Jobs, but this economy contains multitudes, you know, so we will talk about some of them along with jobs with Catherine Rampell. She's at the Washington Post. Kate Davidson's at Politico. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. 390,000 new jobs in this economy last month, 3.6% on the unemployment rate. Is it possible, do you suppose, that that is too many new jobs for where this economy is right now?
No. Oh. I think there has been fear that the economy has been overheating, that, you know, bizarrely, this idea that we could have too many jobs, yeah, or too much nominal wage growth or whatever, you know, I think it's not very intuitive to most people. But it has been a fear that there has been an unsustainable level of demand, right, in the job market, and that could be partly fueling inflation, right?
Yeah.
These labor shortages. However, this was a slowdown for the past few months. We had labor force participation go up, which is what you want to see happening right now, particularly since there are so many more vacancies than unemployed workers. I think this was sort of the Goldilocks moment that everybody was looking for, you know, not too hot, not too cold. Doesn't look like there's a recession immediately on the horizon. Also doesn't quite look like the overheating that has been feared. But we don't know. It's 1 month of data, so I don't want to read too much into it.
Yeah, I thought for sure you were going to go at least a little bit the other way and say, yeah, maybe it is. But you know, that's why we have you on the program, Catherine. Kate Davidson, let me ask you this. Two questions in the form of one question. What do you suppose Joe Biden thought when he saw these numbers yesterday afternoon, because he gets them early? And what do you think Jay Powell thought?
Oh, I'll go with Jay Powell first.
Okay.
I think he thought, great, right? Or good. Okay, good. This is what we want. This is what we need to see. We need to see things starting to cool down. Awesome. Joe Biden probably thought, you know, like, all right, well, yes, we need that to happen. We need things to cool down. This is the message the White House is now delivering. But it's so tricky, right? Like, how do you explain to people that, okay, we're going to start slowing down, but that's actually a good thing? Don't worry, Republicans are going to tell you it's disastrous and that the economy is slowing, but really, this is what we expect to see, this is what we want and what we need to see in order to start, you know, reining in inflation, which is the truth.
Right.
But it's just such a tricky message to explain to voters. I think it's not intuitive.
Catherine, what do you make of the White House's efforts the timing doesn't work on this, but to get out in front of the inflation story, right? They're working real hard to make sure that people know that they care, and yet they are challenged because, in all honesty, there's not a whole lot that the executive branch can do about macroeconomic issues.
I would dispute the premise of this question in that I do not think they have gotten out in front of it. I think they spent way too long basically in denial that it was an issue.
Yeah.
Much of last year, not just the White House, a lot of Democrats, frankly, argued that inflation was at best exaggerated by the media, by Republicans. People didn't really care about it, or they only cared about it because they were seeing all this hyperventilating on TV or wherever about gas prices. And that it's not true. People notice when gas prices go up,
right.
They notice when grocery prices go up, et cetera. So I think that they were a little bit slow to come around to messaging on it and actually doing anything about it. As you point out, there is relatively little that a president can do to get prices down. That's the job of the Fed. But they waited until January to announce for Biden to announce his nominees for the three vacant slots on the Fed, even though one of those vacancies predated his presidency and the others were known to be coming down the pike, you know, for a very long time. And they've dragged their feet on some other issues as well, including, you know, things like repealing tariffs and whatever other modest tools they have available. So they're and they know it's a problem now. They're trying to communicate that. And as you say, there's not a ton that they can do, but they're a little late to even figuring out what little, or to even messaging about what little they can do, I think.
Kate, what do you think? Same question.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mostly agree with Catherine, for sure. I think that they, you know, it's worth pointing out, look, that a lot of economists last year were expecting that inflation was going to be transitory. They knew it was going to go up quite a bit in the spring because we saw this big sort of deceleration in prices at the beginning of the pandemic. Everyone was staying home. People weren't spending. So there was going to be some of that, but clearly it hung around. You know, these price pressures hung around a lot longer than people expected. And there were other things happening, right? Think back to where we were last summer, you know, Afghanistan. You know, people were talking about, is he going to renominate Jay Powell? That decision got sort of pushed back because you had all these other things happening. Then you realized, oh, geez, in the fall, inflation, I think that's when people, the administration really started to kind of get their arms around what a problem this was. But yeah, it felt, I think it probably felt like, you know, it was definitely late.
Yeah. So, Catherine, you and I had some fun on Twitter the other night about this morning consult poll in which people, registered voters, it should be said, revealed that they don't know a whole lot about who's responsible for controlling inflation. And basically about a third of people said it was large corporations who have a lot of control. A third of people said it was the president who has a lot of control. And then a third of people got the right answer, which is the Fed has a lot of control. Why does it matter that people don't understand who's responsible for this?
Well, it matters in part because people lash out at the wrong entities for macroeconomic trends that they don't like, whether it's inflation or anything else. They often lash out at the president, who, again, does not control these things, even if the president has some modest tools available. It matters because it can feed bad policies, right? If people don't understand that inflation is driven by supply and demand, for example, and that the primary tool for dealing with it is through interest rates, they might pressure their lawmakers to pursue policies that could make things worse. For example, there is a bill that was introduced in the Senate recently that would effectively implement price controls.
Yeah.
Which I don't think would be helpful. So I, you know, obviously I'm self-interested in saying this, but I think there is a value to journalists trying to explain.
Oh, you and me both. That again is also why we have you on this program. So, you know,
you know, there is value to people understanding these issues, you know, both for the principle of, you know, an informed populace is a population that makes better choices, but also because we want voters to pressure elected officials or unelected officials in some cases to make choices that will help the problem rather than make it worse.
Yeah. Kate, last thing to you, your colleague Victoria Guida had devoted the top of I guess it's your newsletter, Morning Money at Politico, this morning, on the Fed's conundrum. They really want to get inflation down, but they don't want to get inflation to 2% like tomorrow, because that would be bad. Explain that just a little bit, would you?
Right. Yeah, they give me a day off occasionally, Kai. So Victoria was kind enough to take over for this morning. And we talked about this idea.
We got about half a minute, by the way, so go ahead.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea is, right, you know, if you raise interest rates too quickly to try to get very, you know, remember, we're like above 8% inflation right now. Getting to 2% by, say, the end of the year, I mean, you'd crash the economy into recession. You raise rates so quickly. I mean, it just would be sort of disastrous. But also the point Victoria was making is, you know, the Fed's tools affect demand, but there are a lot of other factors that are influencing inflation right now. Supply chain bottlenecks, you know, oil prices rising because of the war in Ukraine. And so some of those factors, it is still possible, will resolve themselves over time. And so if the Fed just rushed to, you know, jack up interest rates very high, very quickly, you know, they might sort of be, I guess, pulling back on healthy consumer demand. That would be bad. So it's complicated, but these things take time. It's a slow process.
Very slow. Kate Davidson at Politico, Catherine M. Pell at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, I mean, you know, stocks were traded. Options were bought and sold. Bonds did what bonds are going to do. We are going to do what we're going to do when we do the numbers. Okay, so Catherine mentioned labor force participation rate. Here you go. There are 164,376,000 people in this economy of ours who are working or would like to work. That is 62.3% of the civilian non-institutional population, if you're a percentages person. And honestly, that labor force is the heart of this economy. And it grew ever so slightly, relatively, in May, 300,000 people, about a tenth of a percentage point, which, as Catherine said, is good news. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that slice of the labor story pie.
3.5 million more people were working or looking for work last month compared with May of last year.
That means they're encouraged about the prospects for finding a job, and they're looking for those jobs and they're finding those jobs. So that's usually very good news for the economy.
Kathy Jones is with the Charles Schwab Center for Financial Research. Schwab is a marketplace underwriter. She says Black workers 25 to 54 made important gains.
The participation rate for prime age Black workers was 81.2%. That's the highest since 2005.
And women's participation rate shot up 0.3% in May. Jones says women drove a lot of the past year's increase. Still, before the pandemic, women's labor force participation was rising rapidly, and they are not back to that pre-pandemic level yet. Neither are men. Betsy Stevenson is a professor of economics at the University of Michigan.
Right now, everybody is looking at the labor force participation rate because they're wondering, what does a full recovery for the U.S. economy look like?
Will we have as many people working? Will we make as much money, as many goods, as many services? What is the new normal? Another reason economists are watching the labor force participation rate is that if it continues to grow, it would let some pressure out of the job market and hold down wage growth. Kenneth Kim is a senior economist at KPMG.
This would help relieve inflationary pressures because there won't be that kind of supercharged demand for goods and services.
But as the pandemic recovery rumbles on and more people enter the workforce, a warning. Again, Betsy Stevenson.
More vulnerable populations, people who tend to earn less, tend to get brought back into the labor force in the later stages of recovery. If a recovery ends too quickly, those folks just aren't brought back in.
As the Fed raises rates and tries to cool the economy down to fight inflation, the window for people to get back in may start to close. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There are, give or take, 100 historically Black colleges and universities in this country, HBCUs. A lot of them were set up in the years after the Civil War, where Black men and women weren't welcome in the places that educated whites. You fast forward to now, and only about 9% of Black college students in America go to HBCUs. But some of those schools have been seeing a pickup. Morgan State University in Baltimore is one of them. Enrollment this year up 11%. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes went to pay a visit.
It's the lead up to finals at Morgan State, and freshman Traviana Jefferson is sitting on the school's quad. She came here to study political science, and she really likes that it's an HBCU.
I do like being surrounded by Black people. We all relate. I love it. It brings more comfort and a bit more security. Yeah, I feel safer here.
Morgan, which was founded in 1867, wants students like Jefferson to be comfortable and safe. The school posted a sign on campus that said Morgan State University, where Black lives have always mattered. Keisha Campbell is Executive Director for Enrollment Services at Morgan.
So you can have those types of open conversations and talk about what that means for you as a person, for you culturally, how you identify with those feelings of, you know, being a Black person in America.
Campbell says another ongoing conversation at the school is around money. It's public, so tuition and fees are about $8,000 a year for undergraduates from Maryland, $18,000 for students from out of state. Still, that's less than half of what most private colleges charge. Pamela Osei is a junior and says the price tag, including her financial aid package, was one of the reasons she chose Morgan.
I liked it. It's close to home. It's in state. Money, financials really do matter.
In fact, 83% of students at Morgan receive financial aid. Again, Keisha Campbell.
The good number of our students are Pell eligible students. And so as a university, we do a lot to assist students with coming to school.
Pell grants, which are provided by the government, are available only to low-income students. And there are other reasons people are now turning to HBCUs, including prestigious alumni, like Vice President Kamala Harris, who attended Howard University in D.C. Robert Mason is founder of the Common Black College application.
For those that might consider an HBCU less than a majority school, that clearly refutes that argument.
That increased enrollment means growing revenue, says Kayla C. Elliott with the Nonprofit Education Trust.
Enrollment is a numbers game, and numbers include budgets, right? So the more students that you enroll, certainly the more tuition dollars that brings, but it also means the more students that you have to support.
And support is crucial if students are going to get their degrees. Morgan State's graduation rate is 46%, which is higher than the average for all HBCUs, but still not where the school wants it to be. Keisha Campbell points out a lot of Morgan students are non-traditional.
It may take them more time because they're not able to go straight through, or they're taking two classes because they're working and supporting their families. And I don't think that's any different than a lot of other schools that you see, but that's also just the world now.
And many upperclassmen have spent a good chunk of their college careers attending classes virtually, including these psych majors gathered in the lobby of the new social sciences building. Junior Alexis Carlone will be the first in her family to get a bachelor's degree.
Going all the way, hopefully. This semester is semestering. No, but yeah, definitely going to finish.
The lobby we're in stretches up about four stories, giving off the vibe that this is a place where you can study old ideas in new ways. For example, Carlone says she's taken Morgan's class on how to provide psychological care specifically for Black people.
Psychology is an old white man's discipline, but you need to know how to apply disciplines to other communities. And if you're only realizing it from one said group, it kind of makes it difficult. And I feel like it doesn't allow you to be as competitive in the workforce.
Right now, only 4% of psychologists in the U.S. are Black. And as Morgan students enter that workforce, the school's growing network lets them be entrepreneurial, says Lene Wharton, another psych major.
I know a lot of people, they kind of think that, like, once you graduate, you have to be in, you're going to be in, like, more of a whiter space. And I just feel like Morgan has shown me that doesn't have to be what you do.
Wharton knows there are Morgan alumni who've been successful and want to hire Morgan students who make it through. That's a cycle that's good for her, for the university, and for the reputation of HBCUs everywhere. In Baltimore, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, mobility does help the economy.
It does indeed. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 348 today, a little over 1%, finished at 32,899. The NASDAQ gave up 304 points, about 2.5%, 12,012. The S&P 500 down 68 points, about 1.6%, 4108 there. For the 5 days gone by, Dow off almost 1%, S&P 500 dropped 1.2%, NASDAQ also gave up 1%. Elon Musk, and this is a quote, he has a super bad feeling about the economy, so he's going to cut 10% of the salaried staff at Tesla. Those are reports that prompted some pushback from President Biden, who, and this is actually true, he wished Musk good luck on his trip to the moon. Shares in Tesla down 9.2%. Bonds down as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 2.94%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We call it the jobs report. The Bureau of Labor Statistics calls it officially the employment situation summary, of which jobs are a part, sure, but so too our wages. And today's, okay, fine, yes, jobs report did give us an idea of where wages are headed, critical, as you know, to the economic plans of one Jerome Powell. Marketplace's Lily Jamali is on wages today.
What's clear from today's jobs report is that most of the growth in wages right now is happening where it's most needed, says Wells Fargo's Sarah House.
Low-wage workers have tended to see the biggest wage increases.
Inflation outstripped wage gains, but House says there are more people working, and they're working more hours, and that might be helping make up the difference.
The fact that so many more workers are collecting a paycheck, that we're seeing aggregate income keep up much better with inflation, and that's allowing consumer spending to remain strong.
Income growth varied depending on the sector. Mining and logging and construction saw some of the biggest gains. And in time for summer, the leisure and hospitality sector saw wage gains as well, says Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute.
So we're seeing those jobs return, and we're seeing employers have to pay a bit more to attract and retain the workers that they want.
But that's not happening across the board, says Kate Bond at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Job openings are especially high in professional and business services. But then when we look at the pace of wage growth, it is a lower pace than it is for leisure and hospitality. So it's a little bit mixed.
This month's report indicates the Fed is off to a good start, achieving a soft landing as it tries to cool inflation, says Andy Challenger of outplacement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas. But he says even a soft landing is going to cause some pain for workers.
That's still going to mean an increase in layoffs, a decrease in employees' bargaining power, and less money flowing into wages.
If the Fed overcorrects, Challenger says we could see a lot more of each of those. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
So here's a question that is not entirely facetious. What do you give a woman who is rich beyond measure, who is admired worldwide, whose place in history, literally her place in history, is more than secure? What do you get her to celebrate a big anniversary? I mean, street parties, sure. Parades and services of Thanksgiving, yes, fine. How about also, and just hear me out now, how about a new subway line? London's Public Transit Authority, Transport for London, TFL, if you're in the know, opened that long-awaited new line last month. Lots of fanfare, of course, but also, as the BBC's Victoria Craig reports, some problems, too.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to your brand new Elizabeth Line service.
It took 13 years and more than $24 billion to get the city's newest rail line officially up and running. Now, the 73 miles of east-to-west track has shortened journey times and provided better connectivity for areas around London in the southeast of England. The Elizabeth Line was the biggest infrastructure project in Europe. But it wasn't without challenges. Not all of the stations on the line have opened yet, and the project was nearly 4 years behind schedule and $5 billion over budget. Even the chief executive of the project admitted the complexity was off the scale, thanks to complications integrating new signaling and software systems.
Dismissing £2 or 3 billion is something that only governments can do. But there are a large number of big infrastructure projects around the world that run over budget and are delivered late. And this one, in the great scheme of things, is not that bad.
That's Tony Travers, a professor at the London School of Economics School of Public Policy. He explains that while billions have been spent on the new line, billions are also likely to go back into the economy because of it.
Lower-income households on the edge of the city now have greater access to city centre jobs, and indeed the city as a whole has greater access to other parts of itself than before, and, you know, mobility does help the economy.
In its first week of operation, riders took more than 2 million journeys on the line. Those figures could bode well for London as the economy moves back toward a pre-COVID normal. In recent months, the government has dropped all precautionary measures and encouraged workers to get back to the office and back on the trains. Andy Lord, TFL's chief operating officer, says ridership has been steadily increasing.
We're running at about 70% on tube. The weekends have been up at high 80s and 90% of pre-pandemic level. We think the Elizabeth Line is going to be the catalyst that the city needs to help the economic recovery.
A key component to London's overall recovery is business travelers. Wi-Fi-enabled trains topping out at 90 miles an hour then offer easy access to both the city's historic financial center near the Bank of England and the skyscrapers of the Canary Wharf investment banking hub.
You'll be able to go direct from Heathrow to Canary Wharf in just under 50 minutes.
And when the Elizabeth Line's three sections are joined up this autumn, that time will shrink by another 10 minutes.
Which is, you know, about nearly half an hour quicker than you could do today. It really does just saves time, which saves money, which gives people greater ability to make better use of their days.
A modern-day train line designed with the public in mind.
Named in your honour, Your Majesty, I would like to now invite you to unveil the plaque.
And given the official royal stamp of approval by the Queen herself. In London, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping with the policy of this program, that if we stop talking about this stuff, we are going to stop talking about this stuff. And I know we haven't talked about this stuff in a while, and that one's on me. The overall unemployment rate in this economy, as you know, steady at 3.6% last month. For black Americans, the unemployment rate went up in May from 5.9% to 6.2%. Okay, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, an indicator perhaps of the progress they're making in the return to economic normal over in Shanghai. Starbucks, CNN reported this today. Starbucks says it has opened about 600 of the 940 stores it has in that city. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.